This podcast was created by the Arts and Junior Cycle team for the Junior Cycle Talks channel.
I see my music as being songs without words, I suppose. You know, I'm an Irish speaker. It's been my experience to grow up as an Irish speaker in an English-speaking capital city. There are these kind of different aspects to my life, being the rural versus the metropolitan versus the English-Irish. So these are all different aspects or filters or points of view. It means that, I suppose, it gives complexity beyond my volition, really.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. My name is Michelle Geraghty, Arts and Junior Cycle Advisor, and today we are delighted to speak with performer, composer and film score arranger Colm Muchanimre. Colm has a unique interest in the Irish language and his music bears distinctive creative hallmarks, which have as much to do with his personality and character as with his technical skill, mastery of his instrument and his expressive playing. So you're really welcome, Colm. It's lovely to meet you today.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So we might start with a really broad question and just, I suppose, your early childhood and your early memories of music playing.
I'm fourth of six children, so it was a busy house, a musical house, a bilingual house. Well, as in, we were brought up as an Irish-speaking family. My dad is from Connemara, my mother is from Leitrim, from Clunny ní Ruaric, Manor Hamilton, and she was raised speaking Irish herself. So my mum, Barbara, comes from a kind of classical music background, and my granny played the violin, and my dad comes from a Seanós song background in Connemara. And so all our lives, I suppose, we grew up with my dad. I suppose he was an amateur song collector, so he would record people around the west coast of Ireland and in the Gaeltachtaí, and he worked in RTE and started off as a primary school teacher in Scoilercon, and then he worked in RTE as a newsreader and journalist, and then he worked in UCD. He ran the Irish Language Laboratory there and the Changlin for many years. I think all of us have naturally gravitated, like out of six of us, I think, you know, my sister Maureen worked for Radio na Gaeltachta, my brother Rory works for TG Cahir as a journalist, my brother Darragh has worked in theatre. So all of us are kind of, you know, I suppose, arty.
While you were still, I suppose, a student from school, you formed the band Kila. What were your experiences like in school?
I went to Scoilercon, a primary school, and they had a very good musical kind of point of view there. And, you know, we've learnt tin whistle from very young age and dancing, and then into Cláiste Éowyn and Eastagon. Cláiste Éowyn had a very strong music tradition going back to the 70s of Davy Spillane went there. And then in our time, the peers that we had then were Liam and Fichtna from the Hottest Flowers. So it was very healthy, and I think there was a concerted effort to encourage the young lads and to get everybody playing. Also, it had that lovely thing that I think is so important in your teenage years, which is when music stops being something that your parents want you to do and becomes something that you want to do for yourself. And I think the thing that's instrumental in that is when you start playing with your peers. We followed Liam and Fichtna's lead out onto Grafton Street and went busking in the mid 80s. And I suppose that was just opened our eyes to all sorts of other possibilities. When you're coming in from the leafy suburbs, you know, I grew up in Blackrock, and you forget how education can be a kind of a lane that you go down, that you funnel your life through. And I think it was just great experience going out onto the street and getting to meet, you know, fellow musicians. So it's like Glenn Hansard was from Ballymun, and Mark Dignam, another singer-songwriter, he was from Finglas, and then Mick Christopher was from Clondalkin. So, you know, it was real educational on a whole other level.
At what point did you say, I want to be a musician, this is the career path I'm going to follow?
I think definitely around the time with starting Kila as a band. Essentially, kind of, bands are like gangs. There's a finding your tribe, whatever that magic thing is. So speaking as a parent of soon-to-be 17 and 18-year-old teenagers, I recognise the single purpose or single-mindedness that they have on certain things now. But I'm kind of staggered at our kind of, you know, self-belief and naivety and idealism.
Let's talk a little bit about what happened after you met Glenn Hansard then and you became a professional fiddle player.
Well, I suppose Glenn, we'd met busking. We'd been busking for a couple of years. Was a year older than me. But in the way of that, in teenage years, I suppose being a year ahead can be like being 10 years older. So he got a record deal and then he put a band together of his musical friends. You know, we were signed to Island Records, and there's a big kind of steep learning curve, I suppose, when you go move from being a recreational musician to being a recording musician. And I think the whole idea of, like, I suppose recording is such a steep and terrifying learning curve when you hear yourself back.
As a composer then, when did that start, or has that always been part of your role or your profession as a musician? Is it a natural progression?
When I look back in retrospect, it certainly really is. For years, I found a huge frustration in playing a single line instrument. I was only hearing a kind of a fragment of the sound I had in my head. So I used a lot of pedals and stuff, looping pedals, and developed that and effects and stuff through the frames. And part of that actually was, it was a great creative breakthrough for me of being able to, you know, layer things up. I suppose when I started playing with the frames, one of the first things we did was, that was exciting as well, was to play my violin through an amplifier and start experimenting with different effects pedals. I suppose a couple of years into it, the looping pedals became a thing. And so what I use nowadays, I kind of refer to it as the recession quartet. So it's just a way of being able to layer myself up. I play a 5-string viola, so I have the range of a deep viola up to a violin. So you can convincingly play some, you know, good kind of chunky cello lines and stuff. I did study classical music as a kid and stuff, but my ear was always quicker than my eye as regards reading music. It was one of those great technologies that enabled me to kind of sketch my vision very quickly and try out harmonies, try out counterpoint. You know, not that I have the terms for those really, but intuitively doing that. The recording process as well with the band, I mean, it's just so educational. You learn stuff every day about mic placement, about sound, about dynamic range, about different instruments, combinations of different instruments and how well they work, and how they can, you can have conflict between piano and bass if you're trying to record both, and which are the frequencies and what range do you decide to put a particular melody or harmony in. I never studied them, but I've kind of picked them up through doing. I suppose that's the sort of learner I was always anyway.
Do you, when you're composing, is it all done through the performance? Do you put pen to paper at any stage?
I'm a firm believer in instruments being on the wall rather than in their cases, because so much inspiration happens like when you're doing something else. So I think it's really important to capture that initial idea. The recorder on your phone, which is great. My phone is just full of fragments of me either singing a tune into it or playing something on a piano or a guitar. And these things are kind of like just little fragments that, you know, you can come back to. That's actually the most important part, I find, is the initial idea. And as well, I suppose, then as you bring it to recording, not to be overly obsessed with the original idea.
Do you start with like a chord pattern, or do you start with, as you say, that little sound?
Mostly it's a chord pattern. I look at actually like chord patterns, like scaffolding, you know, scaffolding for melody. Mm. Or other times it can be a melody that just kind of some persistent ideas that surface and you start noticing them. And I suppose then once you go into the recording mode, you can record the scaffolding first and then put the melody on, and these things develop. And then what can be really interesting is then taking away the scaffolding and looking at you know, so there are all these kind of interesting devices for approaching pieces differently. And I think that's been, say, stuff that I've worked with, like scores and stuff, having worked on soundtracks as well. In a way, what you're doing is kind of furnishing a house with sound, you know, so that, and to make a story relatable and credible. So you need to kind of invest in the story and then imagine what the sound would be and what that place sounds like. Through that, you develop themes, and then you learn a huge amount depending on what the next cue is. You need to transpose it or to slow it down or speed it up or play it in reverse or have echoes of this particular storyline, but that meets another's colliding character. So that... It's really like mixing colour for a painter, I suppose, is what you're talking about. Yeah.
Down to the film scoring there, what's the difference?
There's generally a long lead in between getting a script, and it's at the script idea that you have that spacious creative time where there's no pressure. This may or may not happen, this project. And it's at those points that I like open a folder or set up a folder on my computer, make a home for ideas to go into. So by the time then that the project is realistic, you have a timeline, it's good to go to your laptop and say, okay, well, I do actually have a few ideas here. The difference is, I think there's a freedom in working on film scores and stuff, which is really useful, because when we're working on stuff ourselves, we can be very, we can be inhibited by the, well, what is it I'm trying to say here? And that can be really unhelpful creatively, I find. Whereas if you're working on another project where the story is, it's not about me, I'm not at the center of the story. So we are the musical servants of the song. So your job is to be the best conduit for the song. And the same applies for film score. My first record, Queen Indira, The Hare's Corner, that was my first time kind of having the studio time to myself, in a way. So it was lovely. It was the first time of having the kind of the canvas to myself.
And if we were to play a piece from that, which piece would you play?
I'd play the opening track, actually. Time Will Tell. Opening track of my first debut album. And I think it sums up my influences in a way between traditional, classical, and yeah, the sound that I like. I see my music as being songs without words, I suppose. You know, I'm an Irish speaker. It's been my experience to grow up as an Irish speaker in an English-speaking capital city. There are these kind of different aspects to my life, being the rural versus the metropolitan versus the English, Irish. So these are all different aspects or filters or points of view. It means that, I suppose, it gives complexity beyond my volition, really.
This podcast is for teachers. So what advice might you give to teachers who want to introduce their students to this art form? So to composing or arranging or indeed performing, I suppose.
I think recording is really key. You know, I'd imagine the same is true for an actor to hear your voice back. It can be really challenging. But once you actually get past it, I mean, I can just about listen to my music. But it's really, that's where the learning can happen. And then I think for me, I started off with a four track, you know, one of those kind of cassette four tracks. And just the excitement of putting notes together and harmonies and that level of experimentation, I think the potential nowadays, fostering that, I think, is where you're going to get young people invested and hooked.
The well-being aspect of playing music, like, what does it bring to you?
I remember my mother talking about moving to Dublin, like in the late 50s, her first job, and living in a flat, talking about how her records became like her friends. And so she had her like Beethoven and stuff that she'd listen to. And just being able to play an instrument as well, it's just that you'll never be lonely. It means that you can, regardless of where you are, it's a language. It's a universal language is what music is. But also on a self-care thing, it can be very therapeutic before you even consider of, or how am I feeling, that you can have a way of expressing your feelings before it even surfaces as a good feeling or a bad feeling or a sad feeling or a happy feeling, especially midway through, like maybe age 15 or thereabouts, that there's a kind of a cliff that a lot of musical kids will come to, and kind of a lot of them will give up playing instruments or lessons at that point. I certainly did. And were
did you?
Oh yeah. So were it not for the fact that I was in a band of buskers and, you know, like-minded rascals, it's so bound up in your social connection. So what I would definitely encourage would be to, you know, getting peers to work together and to create something together. And that's where you're going to totally have that kind of level of excitement and achievement and benefits to your self-esteem as well, as regards kind of, you know, creating something that didn't exist. And once you kind of get used to that, it can be very self-sustaining then afterwards.
You have collaborated with an enormous amount of people, The Frames, Damien Rice, well as many, many others. What kind of opportunities does collaborating with other people give you as an artist?
I think the ability to, you know, I think from being in a band, I think, for which, you know, was in The Frames for 20 years plus, 25 years or so, you learn to work with people. It's teamwork. It requires a level of selflessness, a level of sacrifice, a level of investment, a level of maturity, patience. Yeah, patience being the first one, probably. But also, I think, I mean, music as well. I mean, the most important fundamental aspect to music, playing music, is listening. So especially if you're playing with somebody else, I mean, mm-hmm. It's actually active listening, because you're constantly responding. You're constantly adjusting your pitch, or if you're somebody else is slightly out, to meet them somewhere where it's, mm-hmm. you know, you're constantly drifting to harmony. So I think that kind of, once you have worked in that mode for a long time, it becomes very second nature to understand different people when you meet them. And, you know, musicians and artists can be, and creative people can be very irregular. I find it really like constantly fascinating how different people, different musicians' approaches are. I had a really interesting thing a couple of years ago where I was working on a film score, and I worked with, you know, Ethiopian jazz maestro Malatu Astatke, and he's a renowned like pianist and percussionist. We were in a studio, and he agreed to come over and spend the day with us in the studio recording a sequence. And then towards the end, when we'd covered all of the parts of the music for Ethiopia, there was this kind of one cue that needed a piano that was really standard and straightforward, as I thought. And so I asked Malatu, would he mind kind of just seeing as we had the piano there and he was there, and would you mind just lashing it down? And for the life of him, he couldn't understand what I was asking him, just whatever the chord progression was. And yet, for my mind, it was so like ABC. So in that moment, I had a huge kind of musical epiphany as regards where I had felt that his music was so exotic, and he had the same thought about what I was doing. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So that was a real great teaching moment for me. I suppose also it confirmed my suspicion about all of us are kind of so insecure and so blasé about what comes natural to us. And we're all so impressed by the things that don't come second nature to us. And yet everybody takes that for granted themselves, you know? Yeah.
You are obviously a really experienced professional performer. What are the most important things when you're on stage performing to communicate your music to the audience?
Well, communicating with each other, with the other musicians, I think is really key as well. It was interesting to me in my move from, you know, being a member of a band to being a band leader, as regards if I play a gig, it can be anything from me and a piano player to me and 14 other musicians. So it's very much a different responsibility and a different role as regards having to kind of be the meeting point between the audience and the band, and also to keep the band, be the conductor as well. Key, I suppose, is just listening. In my experience, just being willing to be honest, I think, is really where where I've found the most comfortable place. I'm not a person who would have seen themselves being on stage ever. Like, I remember actually a thing that I remember often is like stage fright, you know. So I remember, do you remember the Fesh Cole being at a competition there in the 80s? And
what age would you have been?
From 12, between 12 and 16, I suppose, or 10 and 15 maybe. But I remember one particular experience where I was so nervous that I got up and played, and it was almost like I went to this standing above myself, and it's almost like that was the first time that I discovered that place, and it's a place I go to every time I play now. Do you know, as regards, do you know that it feels like I'm somehow, it's like where the audience disappears, or, you know, and it's kind of, it's so funny because, I mean, it was just kind of terror that showed me into this way of coping. That it means that it's not about me, that it's kind of like I'm just a kind of a midwife to the music, you know.
Do you have the added pressure that it's your own music, it's your own very personal portrayal of yourself
when you're
out there putting your music out there for the first time?
And you know, so from that point of view, like, you're thinking of like songwriters, young songwriters who are actually writing lyrics. I mean, essentially what they're doing is they're bringing their journal into the studio and having the courage to sit in front of a microphone. And so how you manage that experience as a teacher is such a crucial. So I think the whole idea of like, it's so easy to kind of crush people's creative butterflies, and it's so important to just be so mindful of criticism, and especially when you're dealing with young people, how at those ages it can be so hypersensitive, and the courage to never forget how much courage it takes to actually get to that point where they're actually willing to, you know, share an idea that they've had, no matter how modest or how small it is. It's staggering what a little bit of praise can get going, you know.
What projects have you got coming up now? What are you working on at the minute?
I am.
Are you allowed to tell us?
Well, no, I am. Yeah, I've just finished a couple of projects before Christmas. I was working on a documentary about Irish dancing that went out in RTÉ. Essentially, starting off with, you know, telling the history of Irish music and dancing and how we move and how that's interacting with different people we met, be it migrations from Spain and Morocco and Africa, and the ties between that and Shannos, and then to African America. So all of that, yeah. So it was a very big project. And so there was finished that for Christmas and did a show with Imelda May. She was about Irish literary voices. And I just finished a film called Marosha and Frank about a grief-stricken widow who is finding it difficult to get over the death of her husband. And a stray dog shows up and it becomes clear to her that the stray dog is her husband, having come back to her. And so that's kind of a lovely story. I'm going to be working on music inspired by Colin McCann's novel, A Paragon, which is set in the Middle East and Palestine and Israel. So I was over there with Colin in 2018. And it's just kind of creatively, I had no idea I would be doing it, but it's just the music started arriving. And so I've been working with Colm as well in an organisation called Narrative 4. We work with teachers and students around the world, fostering empathy.
What does a typical working day look like for you? Do you set aside a certain amount of time every day to write music, or do you wait?
I think that I think it's an apocryphal story about Irving Berlin or one of those guys, and saying, you know, Mr. Berlin, which comes first, the lyric or the melody? And he replies, the phone call. You know, so it's kind of inevitably deadlines are useful. So there's a lot of procrastination that happens.
Reflection and refining and editing is part of Junior Cycle.
Yeah.
How do you refine and reflect and edit your work?
Setting yourself deadlines is good. Mm. And even as an experiment of giving yourself an hour to work on this idea, and then you move on to the other idea, regardless of how you're doing. Another thing that happens a lot is that you get bogged down in a particular tune. So it can be really useful to either go out for a walk or switch over to something. A lot of the art comes from knowing when to, like, negotiating flow. So when something is flowing to actually, well, things are going really well, let's keep on with this when it's going, or just things are tapering off.
And how do you know then when it's done? Are you a real procrastinator? Do you work right up until the deadline? Or do you just kind of, is there a moment where you go, that's it, it's perfect now?
In recording wise, it's never done until the actual recording. It's always growing. And then oftentimes after the recording is finished, some tunes still, you play them live and it's evolving as well. But for the most part, they kind of tell you know when it's done. Or, I mean, you know, are paintings finished or are they abandoned is the other thing, you know. But I think having parameters, there's a great kind of, I think it was Orson Welles or one of those guys who was supposed to have said this, but that the true enemy of art is an absence of limitation.
When you were arranging for your orchestral works for your film scores, do you do all of that using technology?
So I have Sibelius. That's been a great tool for the past couple of years, you know, because being a far more of an ear person than a sight reader. But so just having both together where, you know, plays it back to you and you can actually see the the rests and everything. And also, obviously, you know, when I can't afford an orchestra, which is most of the time, I can layer it up myself or get some players in. Then also, like, there's fantastic MIDI strings, you know, virtual instruments that you can use. But I think there's a balance with that as well as regards kind of, I think personality is a huge thing when you're recording music. So you want it to have some sort of identity which is yours. Oftentimes, actually, as you start off, the first thing you want to erase is the thing that makes it sound like you most. Mm. And actually, probably that's the thing that you're going to come around to full circle and recognize is that that's your unique contribution that you have in the world.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up on that identity that you have created, that sound that you have. Is that something that you did kind of, was it subconsciously?
I suppose it's a taste thing. Everybody stacks a chord differently. Intuitively, my chord choices aren't the same as everybody else, but a lot of people perhaps who come through training learnt more how it's done, because I've known some spectacular players who are so afraid when you took the sheet away.
We might finish with another performance from Colm, this one from his new record, The River Holds Its Breath.
Yeah, it's a piece called Late Afternoon.
Thanks, Colm, for joining us today, and I want to wish you every success in your future projects.
Thanks, Megan. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, which was created by the Arts and Junior Cycle team for Junior Cycle Talks podcast channel. To hear more from Junior Cycle Talks, search for us on SoundCloud or anywhere you listen to your podcasts.